From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, I'll speak with Kristen Higgins about her latest, Good Luck With That, published by Berkeley. Kristen Higgins is the New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and Publishers Weekly bestselling author of nearly 20 novels, which have been translated into more than 24 languages and have sold millions of copies worldwide. Her books have received dozens of awards and accolades, including starred reviews from Kirkus, the New York Journal of Books, Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, and Booklist. She's a five-time nominee for the Kirkus Prize for Best Work of Fiction, and her books regularly appear on the lists for Best Novels of the Year of many prestigious journals and review sites. In Good Luck With That, Kristen tackles the issue of body image and self-acceptance. Emerson, Georgia, and Marley have been best friends ever since they met at a weight loss camp as teens. When Emerson tragically passes away, she leaves one final wish for her best friends: to conquer the fears they still carry as adults. For each of them, that means something different. And as Marley and Georgia grow stronger, the real meaning of Emerson's dying wish becomes truly clear. More than anything, she wanted her friends to love themselves. A novel of compassion and insight, Good Luck With That tells the story of two women who learn to embrace themselves just the way they are. When I spoke with Kristen Higgins, I began by asking why she was inspired to write this book. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I'm one of those women who has always struggled with body image and, you know, found myself lacking. And as a writer, I've had a variety of sizes and shapes of my heroines and protagonists, but I never really tackled the issue of weight and how it follows us and haunts us as women. You know, I've written characters who are really skinny and little. I've written a 6-foot-tall heroine. I've written curvy heroines, you know, where they think, oh, I need to lose 15 pounds, but they're delicious and luscious and, you know, quite desirable. I've done the Cinderella story where, you know, you lose weight and you get the haircut and suddenly you're better looking. And I felt like I was sort of pussyfooting around the image, the issue of body image, and that I had never really honestly tackled it in a way where it was still present for the woman or the women in my book. You know, either they lose weight or they become healthier or they're just fine the way they are. And I wanted to write a book. It just felt like time to really honestly address how much body image affects us and what the messages we get are, how they hit our hearts and shape our lives, and how they're so constant and so contradictory sometimes. You know, we all know that what really matters is how we treat people, the things that we do, the people that we are, you know, loyalty, intelligence, humor, those are the things that matter. And yet, you know, you can't leave the house without being told you look wrong, right, by society, by, you know, people, by magazine covers, by movies. We're always being bombarded with these messages of look a certain way, and that way is usually slim, toned, fit, you know, the kind of figure that would require basically 8 hours in the gym and measuring out every cup of food that you ate. And then we're also bombarded with all these messages of food. You know, we're Americans. We love to eat. Yeah. We love to overeat, you know.
Right.
There was a, right before I went on book tour for Good Luck With That, my daughter and I went to the grocery store, and we were standing in line at the checkout counter, and there was a magazine, and it said, lose 20 pounds in a week.
Oh, God.
And my daughter, who's 22, said, how do you do that? Do you cut off a leg? And I said, you know, that would be easier than what's inside this magazine, you know.
Right.
just imagine what they're going to tell you to do, lose 20 pounds. And also on that magazine cover was your best chocolate cake recipe ever.
Yeah.
You know, so lose 20 pounds in a week, but also eat this cake.
Yeah.
And that's the world we live in, you know. So I wanted to write a book about size, sizeism, the difficulties of being large, you know, because I think we tend to ignore that. We tend to turn away from the stories of people who are as big as Emerson is in the book.
Right. I loved the opening of the book, which is, you know, if anybody who opens this book knowing anything about it is going to expect a sort of sad or difficult or, you know, problem opening. And the opening of this book is carefree and literally weightless because they're all out swimming. and I just loved that. And I wondered how you came to that opening. When in the process of writing the book did that actually come into your pages?
All right. So the opening of the book came for me at the end of the book because I don't always write in sequence. And I knew that that first chapter in which Emerson is in the hospital and Georgia and Marley go to visit her was going to be very difficult to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to show these three women as they were in their innocence. You know, when they're 17 years old, they're at a weight loss camp where they have become fast friends. And it's their last day, and they go swimming. And they are metaphorically and literally weightless in the water. And for once, their size isn't a factor. They're just girls having a great time, friends, you know, enjoying nature. And I wanted to kind of show them in this pure sense of this is who they are, outside of the reach of the world, the negative messages that girls get, and just really enjoying each other.
Yeah. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was a very fun scene. It was very summer camp, which is what it is, even though it's a camp for eating, you know, for overeaters. But in that moment, there's nothing about that. It's just fun at camp with best friends.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was a great opening. So now soon after that, there is this interesting moment in the book that I wanted to ask you about from a writing perspective, and that is naming something without immediately explaining it. So Marley mentions Frankie. You know, in her thought process, she thinks about Frankie, or she even maybe addresses a thought to someone named Frankie, but there is no explanation about who Frankie is. And then we do find out eventually who Frankie was. And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, naming something without immediately explaining it.
Sure. Well, just for your listeners, Frankie is Marley's twin who died when they were four. And I did a lot of research on twins without a twin and twin loss, and one of the things that seemed ubiquitous is that your twin is always with you, even after they die. And so Marley especially carries Frankie and Frankie's memory with her. She barely remembers her twin, and yet she feels the loss so acutely. She feels half of a whole. So it's very natural, I think, for her to constantly be thinking of Frankie. She you know, prays to Frankie, please, Frankie, help Emerson get better, you know. As someone, I lost my dad when I was young, and, you know, I do the same thing, you know, in the pantheon of people you address in times of need, dad is always first, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that for a twin especially, and especially because Marley suffers from survivor's guilt, she's always got Frankie in the forefront of her mind. So rather than information dump on the reader, you know, I wanted to kind of weave it in more naturally so that Frankie's part of who Marley is and always in her thoughts. And then, you know, you do learn just why.
Yes. And
do you think from the perspective of the craft of writing, it creates some sort of tension for us or some sort of suspense, even on a very tiny level, to have an element floating out there that we know we will find out about and that we haven't yet?
I do. You know, I think that we have to respect readers' intelligence, you know, that they will stick with it. They know that if you're addressing someone who's not in the scene, that person is important, and you'll find out where their role is. You know, the idea of stating everything up front is a little graceless for me, to say, you know, the first time Frankie's name is mentioned, to do an aside,
right,
my dead twin, you know.
Sure.
It seems rather awkward that way.
Right, right.
So, you know, I always enjoy it as a reader, getting pulled into the story, like, who is this character?
Right.
And what role does she play?
Yeah. Now, Emerson does pass away very early in the book. I think that we can say that.
Yes.
And it's very sad, but the something that happens that makes it really interesting is that she has, and when they were kids, they created this list together.
Yes.
It's a list of what we'll do when we get skinny. And I just loved this aspect of the plot. And just an aside, I won't spoil anything else, but since this happens so early on, I thought it would be okay. But campers and teens generally do make lists. I just thought it was this perfect moment of showing who they had been as you know, children, really, but teenagers. And then applying some of that to who they are as adults in the form of this list that she bequeaths to her friends and for them to have a look at. And, you know, really she wants them to do the things on the list. And it changes them. It does. So I loved this. I wondered if you remember when you decided to include the list in the story.
That was really, really early on.
Yeah.
I knew that I wanted to address the issue of thin privilege. You know, the things that we women and girls who are not that size, you know, that ideal sylph-like athletic size that I personally never was, you know, I remember, you know, looking at them and thinking, I could never wear a shirt that way. I would look terrible in that outfit, or trying to imitate it and coming up short. And you make this list, you know, when I'm skinny, I'll apply for my promotion, or when I'm skinny, I will really rock that white dress or that bathing suit. You know, when I'm skinny, men will like me more, or I'll have more friends. You know, whatever it is, I think it is a very human quality.
Yeah.
To look to the future and say, when I'm exactly where I want to be, all my life will fall into place.
Right.
And the thing about the adult Georgia and Marley is, weight loss is not a goal. You know, they're not doing the list to say, like, when we're skinny, all these things will be great. Marley does the list. She's a plus size woman, and she says, I'm doing the list, but I'm not losing weight. Georgia is losing weight, but not for good reasons. She's ignoring a health issue, but the seduction of being thinner is something that she's been told all her life. You know, you need to be thinner. She's wanted to be thinner. She's got this obsession with her own size. She's never been able to accept herself as she was. She's, you know, an overeater. She's done binging and purging and, you know, everything in between. And so they take this list, which is filled with all this adolescent longing of, you know, when we're skinny, life will be better. And they say, they've promised Emerson that they'll do it. And they admit, like, some of the things on this list are really dumb. Like, one of them is getting a piggyback ride from a guy.
Yeah.
But if you picture, you know, if you picture yourself at 17, overweight, and the idea of getting a piggyback ride is this magical thing of, like, we'll be spontaneous and we'll be smaller than the guy, and it won't be a thing, you know, it won't be embarrassing, it won't be impossible for him to do. So they're very innocent little things. And yet what that says is, you know, kind of like, I don't believe that could happen today, or you know, I can be spontaneous and fun, and my boyfriend will be big and strong and that kind of thing.
Right.
So
right.
They edit the list, they add to it, they delete some things, like Georgia says, I'm never getting a piggyback ride from a guy. That's stupid, I won't do it, you know. and Marley does eventually get a piggyback ride, doesn't go quite as planned, but, you know, the message is there. And so the plot, as the women move forward, dealing with their grief over Emerson and their feelings of guilt that they didn't know what she was going through or how sick she had become through complications related to her size, because she's what's called super morbidly obese in the medical world.
Right.
They start on this path of, like, doing these things forces them to confront some of their deeper issues. And it doesn't have to do with their size. It has to do with how they were raised, the beliefs that they hold about themselves based on childhood wounds. You know, Georgia has this terrible family. Her mother and brother are pretty horrible people.
Yeah.
And Marley, on the other hand, you know, she was the twin who lived. She was big and strong, and her size was celebrated. And she's from this big Italian family, and they love to eat together. And so they have to kind of look at the idea of size and kind of erasing that from their self-image and the way they view themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's not how you look in a pair of jeans or what size those jeans are. It's really getting past those messages that you're supposed to be a certain size.
One thing that I loved was that the list is really made from that 17-year-old mindset. I mean, actually, I think I have another question about competition later, but I think part of it is, it's apart from being overweight, it's a very human thing to feel competition. And
yeah.
The list, like the thing about the piggyback ride, like you can just imagine the slight, beautiful, laughing girl who is on the shoulders of some guy being carried off. Mm-hmm. And being 17, I mean, who among us wouldn't feel some jealousy seeing that happen at 17, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
And, you know, as a 35-year-old, you look and you say, like, you know, getting a piggyback ride isn't a life achievement.
No.
But you get that sense of longing of some girls get to do that, and I'm not one of them.
Right, and if anybody ever had done that, which personally I don't remember that ever happened to me, but you might look back on it fondly, even if it wasn't something you'd want to do now.
Right. My husband is a firefighter, and he will occasionally pick me up. And I say, you're going to drop me, like I'm convinced that I'm too large to be held,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's always a little terrifying, you know? And he has never dropped me. He's big and strong. And yet, in my own view of myself, like, I'm too large to be carried without causing him a hernia.
Right. Now, you decided, as you wrote, well, maybe you decided, or maybe this just happened and you decided it was a good idea, but you never fully shared Georgia and Marley's sizes or weights. Which was interesting to me. I wondered if you want to just talk a little bit about that decision.
I did share Emerson's weight. I wanted to make sure that readers knew she was, you know, really disabled by her size. You know, she wasn't chunky or you know, 100 pounds overweight. She had difficulty getting out of bed, you know, leaving the house, sitting in a chair. I wanted to make sure that it was clear that she was a food addict, and like any addiction, had a very, very hard time living in that world of addiction and getting to that point. So I did share her weight, which is over 600 pounds. For Georgia and Marley, I wanted the reader to bring their own image there. We know about Marley that she can't, she has to shop in a plus-size store. They call it the normal stores. She can't shop in Banana Republic or J. Crew, which is, I can't shop in J. Crew, and I you know,
yeah,
still resent that. And so we know that she's a big woman, that she's plus size, that she's curvy, and that she's also very healthy. She loves going to the gym. She runs. She takes Zumba and yoga. She's kind of a fitness junkie who also loves food. She's a personal chef, and she's never going to lose that weight, you know. And she thinks, I don't want to live that way of measuring food and never having a glass of wine and that kind of thing. Georgia is like a lot of us, like me in particular. She's been heavier. She's been skinnier. She's somewhere in between when we meet her, and she doesn't really know how big she is. I think it's called body dysmorphia. When she looks in the mirror, she's not sure what she sees. And as she does lose weight because of this health issue she's ignoring, she starts to feel like she's disappearing. And, you know, she does get to that point where she can shop in the, you know, the quote-unquote regular stores.
Yeah.
And it's not really the life-changing experience that she thought it was going to be when they were 17. You know, it doesn't do for her. It's not a magic bullet of saying, like, wow, I went to this yoga store and bought their clothes and my life is no different and I don't feel better about myself. And that's, I mean, Georgia has a lot of work to do on her self-image and negative perceptions of herself. But I really wanted the readers to picture them in their own minds and kind of bring their own issues to the book. You know, how much does Marley weigh? You tell me, you know?
Yeah. I thought that was really a really smart thing to do. I think that one way to really convey the message that body image shouldn't be our obsession is to not let us know exactly what the people weigh, but to let us into their minds and to see the way that they feel about themselves.
Yeah. One of the things that that I talk about with Georgia is that as she loses weight, she loses weight at two points in her life, once for her wedding, and then as she's sick, and when she's lost weight for her wedding, the way people treat her weight loss is, I think, very common. It's like the most incredible thing she's ever done. And here's a woman who's graduated from Princeton and Yale and UNC and holds all these degrees and is rather fabulous and kind and generous and so smart, and everyone's like, oh my God, you look so skinny. Like, that's the best thing she's ever done.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she thinks, like, yeah, you know, it's weight, you know, it's, and I see that in, and I think we all see it in society. Oh, Melissa McCarthy has dropped 50 pounds, or how did she do it? And half their size, and, you know, all these, this focus on this amazing accomplishment that you've pulled off, of losing weight. And don't get me wrong, you know, like, there are people who feel they need to lose weight for medical reasons, and when they do it, they should be celebrated. But it's not the best thing they ever did.
Right.
You know, raising their children, I would say,
right,
is more important, or the job that they do, or, you know, it shouldn't be heralded as, like, this is incredible, and you should be praised for it.
It's
the most significant accomplishment of your life.
And I have a friend who has an anorexic teenage child, and it drives my friend crazy when people will tell this child how fabulous she looks when she is really unhealthy. And, you know, at certain points in her life when she's been really unhealthy, people have approached them and said, oh my goodness, you look so fantastic. You know, and it's how Karen Carpenter became anorexic. There was, I think, an article covering some of their early concerts for the Carpenters, and they described her as chubby, and it sent her down this road where she died. I mean, our obsession with people's bodies is terrible. So
right. I have a friend who has a chronic disease, and weight loss is one of the side effects, and she tries very hard to keep weight on,
mm-hmm,
and inevitably someone will say, you look amazing, and she's sick of it, and she's like, well,
I have this condition, and my medication has all these side effects, and I'm actually underweight and really sick, and thank you. Thanks a lot for telling me I look great. I'm trying not to die here. But at least I am a size 6.
Yeah, exactly. Right, now, I wanted to know, and you know, obviously I wrote this question before we started talking, so I know that, that you've mentioned, you know, having your own body image awareness, or maybe over-awareness, whatever, but I wanted to know if you did any research, any interviews, things like that, perhaps with people who are really very large, more in Emerson's size range. Did you do any research like that?
I did, and I did a lot of it. I tend to over-research. I spent 3 months researching the issue of weight loss, the science of fat, physiology, and what it's like to be morbidly obese and super morbidly obese. And again, that term is from the medical community, and it, I think they need to think of something else.
Right.
But I read a lot of books. You know, written by doctors about the benefits that fat brings to your life, why you gain weight at different times of your life, how natural that is. I read books about how the food industry has kind of screwed us with the use of fructose and all this and all our food and portion size and food availability. You know, you can get a meal delivered to your house by Uber at 2 o'clock in the morning if you want.
Right.
Big Mac, you know. And I watched a documentary called All of Me about women who were morbidly obese and a group of them who decide to get weight loss surgery and how it works for a few and fails for a few. And I did, but I think the most poignant and meaningful research I did was talking to people who are significantly overweight, who are Emerson size, who are who have to worry, like, will this chair hold me? Will I sit through this restaurant when I walk in with my friends? And some of them were anonymous. I posted a question on Reddit, that black hole of the universe, and and people were really, really lovely and generous about sharing their experiences. And so I did learn a lot about the struggles that you have when you are a food addict, a compulsive overeater. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted to write Emerson, and her point of view is shown throughout the book in her journal entries, I wanted to address the fat phobia that, that our country has. You know, it's so ironic and hypocritical. We live in a fat nation. 2/3 of us are overweight. You know, 1/3 of us are obese, according to the National Institute of Health. But when you see someone Emerson size who cannot walk anymore because of her weight, you think, how did you get like that? And we judge them. We think, like, didn't, you know, wasn't 300 pounds overweight enough, and, you know, don't you know you should just eat less? And we're so dismissive of that kind of addiction, in a way that we're not with alcoholics or opioid addicts. You know, we're very, we have all these programs and sympathy, and yet when someone is a food addict, we tend to either look away and pretend it's not a thing, or we tend to discriminate against them. And I've had so many letters from readers since the book came out saying, this book really opened my eyes as to how I have judged people of that, of Emerson's size. And I feel like I'll be more compassionate now when you read about someone. And that, so that was very, very meaningful to me, to be able to present her as this lovely, intelligent, insightful character who has suffered great loss, and she's an orphan. Her parents die when she's way too young, and she has some trauma in her childhood, and it talks about, this is how you get here. she addresses that.
Right.
But you want to know how I got here, I'll tell you. And a lot of that came from the stories that people shared with me.
Yeah, that's great that you were able to reach out and find people who were willing to talk about it. And I mean, that is really the internet at its best, isn't it? When you can post something out there and you'll connect with other people. They probably feel good about being able to contribute to this project. And that's amazing.
And I also talk to friends. You know, I have friends who are obese and friends who are underweight and friends who are in between. And you know, we had a weekend, actually, where we, you know, five of my closest friends and I sat down and we talked about size. And, you know, I'm somewhere in the middle, and one of my heavier friends said, like, I can't believe we have so much in common, Kristen. You know, like the way we eat, the experiences that we've had, because she just looked at me and said, well, you're skinnier than I am, so you haven't been in these shoes. I'm like, no, I'm right there with you, you know.
Yeah.
And whether it's genetics or whatever, you know, I don't know, 50 pounds lighter than she is. But I wanted this book to represent more than my own experience. So I wanted it to be about, and Georgia is pretty much the, you know, my own closest experience. And I wanted to do it right for Emerson. So I did as much research as I could.
Yeah. Do you mind if I read a little section and then we can talk about it?
Yeah, sure.
This, I think, is relevant to the conversation you and your friends had over the weekend that you got together. It's a section from Emerson's journal. Okay, I'm just going to read it and then we can talk about it. She writes, "Funny thing about fat people, we discriminate. Hells yes, we do. Our first thought upon seeing a fellow fatty is, thank God I'm not the only one. Second thought in my case is, crap, I'm fatter than she is. And then we think, at least I think, are you going to be nice to me or are you going to compete with me? And if you compete with me, are you going to win? Can I lose more weight than you? Can I be the skinnier one? Because the fat life is all about weight, always, forever. That's something Marley and Georgia understand. Georgia, more so than Marley. Marley wanted to be thinner, but she didn't seem as obsessed as Georgia and I were. She has that great family. Her mom used to send contraband food, and Marley was so funny when the counselors took it. Anyway, she's always been heavy, but in a nicer way to Georgia and me. And even Georgia isn't in my world of the super obese. I try not to hold that against them." I thought that was such a poignant paragraph because these are her best friends and these are her favorite people. And even in that world, there is the sort of like comparing yourself to someone else, a little undercurrent of competition, which, as I said, seemed super, just very human and very relatable. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that aspect of it, and also her journal, and just if you enjoyed, you know, from the perspective of writing the book, if you enjoyed working on the journal while you were working on the book.
Sure. Well, as to the first part of your question, not every woman does this, you know, of course. So we're talking about three women, but I think a lot of women do. We look at each other and say, you look great. You look, you know, or I'm the skinniest person in the room, or I'm the biggest person in the room, or how is she so little? And it was funny, my editor and I met to talk about this book, and we had lunch together, and she's this little bitty thing who is a like passionate cyclist, and she's like, you know, I look at you and I say, God, I wish I had Kristen's height and figure. And I said, and I look at you and I said, God, I wish I was petite like Claire. <You know? laughs> and then we talk, you know, it turns out, you know, she had lost a lot of weight and, you know, and she said, oh, I'm obsessively counting calories even now. And, you know, how many miles will I have to ride my bike before I can burn off this lunch? And you know, you think it just seems so, so common.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think there's that, you know, when you are overweight, you can never get away from it. You know, people will remind you, or, you know, whether it's just you pass them on the street or they look at you funny. I had this experience where I was learning to swim. I can swim a little bit, but I took swimming lessons this past winter because I was tired of not being a good swimmer and being afraid of the water. And there was a woman in the lane next to me, and she was a really good swimmer. And she just, like, she was so graceful and slow in the water. And like, I'm always panicking. And, you know, the lifeguard is usually, like, walking up and down next to me. Like, here I don't drown, you know. And I'm, like, kicking frantically and splashing and sucking in water. And she was, like, this beautiful sea creature. And she was also morbidly obese.
Uh-huh.
And I waited for her to be done with her laps because I wanted to say to her, like, how did you get to be such a good swimmer, you know, you know, you want to be friends, you want to teach me. And she wouldn't, like, I waited for 5 or 10 minutes. I was kind of lingering, and I didn't want to be obvious. And then I thought, like, well, I have to go, and she's got miles more to swim, it seems. And then I left, and I thought, I wonder if she thought I was going to say something about her size. Because I was in the middle of writing this book, and I thought, you know, I wonder if I made her feel bad about herself. When all I wanted to do was say, you're such a great swimmer, you know, how did you learn to be so easy in the water? And so it was just, you know, it was just this thing that occurred to me, like maybe she was afraid to talk to me because she thought I was going to be mean or something.
Yeah.
But the second part of your question about Emerson's journals, they were heartbreaking to write. You know, mm-hmm. She was the hardest character. Obviously, she has a tragic story, and
yes.
And her death is not a plot device. It's a tragedy. There are people who die from obesity and complications thereof, and she had all the complications. And when you write a character of that size, there's only two paths, really. One is to lose weight. And one is to continue on with the inevitable ending that your body is not meant to carry this much weight and it is going to fail you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote, I knew that a third of this book, you know, this character would be a tragic character. And so I wrote all her journals first before I wrote anything else because I think she is the cornerstone of the book, you know, that her life and her death are where Marley and Georgia start. And realizing that her life was lonelier, sadder, harder than they knew, and that she did not get a chance to see herself the way they saw her, which was as the lovely, funny, worthy friend that they really enjoyed and adored. And so I wrote all her pieces first, starting kind of backwards with the idea that she was going to, you know, there's this chapter, her first journal entry is, today is the first day of the rest of my life. I'm going to start being healthier. I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to eat better. And we kind of go back in time to that first chapter where she dies. So her point of view is sort of told in reverse.
Yeah.
Of like the 5 or 6 years leading up to the point where she is in that hospital bed.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too, from the perspective of writing the book, that you wrote the whole journal together so that there would be a continuity there, even though as readers we see it in sections split up between other prose. But that
right.
That makes a lot of sense to me that you did it that way, too. Kristen, I'm going to change gears a tiny bit here and ask you, my show is for writers and curious readers. So for the readers who are listening, I wonder if there's anything else you've read lately that you would recommend to listeners.
Oh, sure. Well, I love a good romantic comedy, and that is where I started my writing career in rom-coms. And I read a really fantastic one recently called Intercepted, by Alexa Martin.
Okay.
And it's about a girlfriend of an NFL player in Denver. And Alexa herself is married to a former NFL player. And it was so funny and so smart. I actually had it on the airplane with me when I was on book tour. And I was laughing so hard that people were turning around to look at me, and I would just hold up the book cover and say, write it down, it's fantastic. So that was a joy to read. I love to read dark suspense, so I'm reading a book called I See You by Claire McIntosh, which is like deliciously creepy and stalkery. I know. And I just finished Sherry Thomas's A Study in Scarlet, which is the first book in her Lady Sherlock series.
Oh.
So she's reimagined Sherlock Holmes as a woman in Victorian times, and Charlotte Holmes is you know, on the spectrum, brilliant, very independent, a woman on her own, much to the disapproval and horror of her family. And it's brilliant. It's wonderful.
Well, that's great. I love that you quickly came up with three in a row. Boom, boom, boom.
Thank you. Yeah, I tend to read more than one book at a time. And I often read books before they come out because publishers will send them to me.
Sure.
Or maybe a blurb or something like that. And so I'm lucky that way. And I, you know, I do love to read. So
that's great.
I'll grab the nearest book to me and just pop it open.
Oh, that's fun.
But those three were standouts.
Now, let's see. What are you writing next? Do you know? Have you started working on the next one?
Well, my next book is actually finished.
Oh, okay.
It will come out next summer. It's called Life and Other Inconveniences. And it's the story of three generations of women in a family that is not warm and fuzzy. There's Genevieve London, who is 85 years old, and this very proper Connecticut blue blood who raised her granddaughter until her granddaughter got pregnant at 18 and refused to give up the baby. And so Emma is now 35 and the mother of a wonderful teenage daughter, Riley, who's 16, and circumstances dictate that they have to spend a summer together after 18 years of not seeing each other or speaking.
That's great.
So, yeah, that'll be fun, and so that's out next summer. And then I'm writing a book now, but it's I'm sure you know from interviewing so many writers, don't ask a writer what they're working on at the moment, because we'll just go off into the weeds and stay there for an hour and a half.
Well, I have a follow-on question. How long does it usually take you to write a book?
It takes me about 9 months, which is appropriate, and that's the usual time you spend gestating a baby. So I when I was writing a series, I could write two books in a year, but a great personal toll, and now I'm writing one a year, and I find that for me, you know, my books have a lot of messages and plot lines to be tied up. There's research to be done. So I really like having the extra time.
Yeah.
I'm not a believer in churn them out, even though one book a year seems, you know, pretty productive for me. But like in the world that I live in, it's nothing. You know, I have friends who write four books a year.
And oh, my gosh.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Remember our conversation about like competition? I'm sitting here super jealous that you can do something like that in 9 months. All right. So my last question is always a question for offering advice to writers who might be listening. And in this case, I wonder if you have advice for developing story ideas that might have a positive impact in some way.
Sure. All my books start with pretty much a one-line idea. You know, what if your friend died and left you the list that of the things you wanted to do when you were 17? Mm-hmm. And to develop that idea, I always try to start with who is the worst person for the job here, who is going to like this task the least, because that makes it a little more fun for the reader to have the character in conflict. And I try to keep all parts of the character's life in motion. So there's something happening in their job, and something happening with their family, and something happening on their, you know, personal life, something happening with their friends, so that the story is constantly in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you write about lovely people with lovely families and lovely friends doing lovely things, you don't really have a novel. You just have a happy life.
which is great, but it's not really fun to read. So
yeah, I think Tolkien said happy stories are wonderful to live and boring to read about.
That's great. What a great quote. I'm going to have to look that up. I want to mention again that the name of the book is Good Luck With That, a novel by Kristen Higgins, and it's published by Berkeley. Kristen, thank you so much for speaking with me today about Good Luck With That.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with the best-selling author, Kristen Higgins. You can learn more about her work at her website, kristenhiggins.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Kristen Higgins. You wake up in a strange room, in a strange bed, and there's a stranger in the room. He knows you extremely well and seems to assume you know him also. Write about what happens next. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. We're winding down here, but I'm going to finish up a little bit here with my theme song and tell you to please have a great week. It's been a pleasure being here with you this Monday. Take care.